stayed vivid over the years, while others fade. I discovered that old saw about remembering very clearly something you did 40 years ago, but not knowing what you did yesterday is actually true. Or at least it's becoming true in my case. And among the memories that have remained vivid for me are the week-long revival meetings that were held in the Baptist church in which I was raised. I know I've spoken about them before. They could make for some really, really high drama at times. The way it would go would be the visiting evangelist. You'd always have somebody coming in from out of town to conduct these services for a week, usually through a week in the spring or the fall. And the visiting evangelist would get to the end of his sermon and then segue into what was called the invitation. The invitation was to come forward to the front of the church and be saved. We would always sing the same hymn, "Just As I Am," without one plea. I can still to this day recite all four verses from memory. I think I'll spare you that, but I can do it, believe me. For it was not unusual, you see, we would sing this song through several times. As long as the evangelist and the regular minister were convinced that there were still some lost souls out in the pews somewhere who needed to come forward and receive Jesus. For that was what salvation in this setting meant. You stood before the congregation and you acknowledged that God, through Jesus' life and death, had redeemed you from your sins, and henceforth you would lead a good and clean a life as you could with the help of God and Jesus. Now, you had no choice about being a sinner. You were born with that. It was called original sin. But you could be redeemed from it. You could be baptized, you could join the church, and you could live in a redeemed state. Some of those who would come forward and be greeted by the evangelist and the regular church minister, they would stand together in the front of the church there. They would come forward and they would weep, both over their lost state and how joyful they were to be delivered from it. And then after the service, other members of the congregation would come forward to offer their support, and this could also get very emotional, lots of tears and huggings and all that kind of stuff. I am telling you, it was really, really powerful stuff. I don't think we have anything that quite measures up. Well, I would watch all this as a kid, sort of pre-teens and up into my early teenage years. I would watch all this with a mixture of awe and fascination and some discomfort as well, because I wondered how many more rounds of "Just As I Am" are we going to do before I can go home. It was getting late. I had school the next day. I probably had a few homework assignments I still hadn't finished up, and we were still here in church. But I knew we had to wait so that folks could get saved. Now, my own route to salvation actually was a rather comparatively sedate one. I mean, it was in the same church, but a comparatively sedate one at the age of 11. I had a talk with my regular minister. Visiting evangelists always kind of scared me a little bit, but the regular minister was a nice guy. He was a good guy. He was somebody I greatly admired. And so I had a talk with him about what it meant to receive Jesus. And I got baptized by immersion, like most Baptist churches, right about where these four pipes are. We actually had a tank that you would stand in before the congregation at night with the lights out and lights flash, lights fixed on the baptistry, and you would be completely baptized by total immersion, showing you were dying to one life and coming up to live a new life in Jesus. Again, powerful stuff. But that was it. I just wanted to have this talk with my minister, get myself baptized, and kind of get on with my life, because even at that young age, this sort of innate reserve and shyness that I know I carry around, I mean, it was still pretty well in place there at the age of 11. So yeah, I wanted to be saved. I wanted to know I was going to heaven. I just didn't want to make a great big deal out of it. Well, I know it's easy to make light of all that all these years later, but I really did see some lives markedly change for the better due to this kind of salvation. And my father never tired of telling me, how his own life would have been a mess if he hadn't found Jesus. And he was probably right. It kept him on the straight and narrow way and enabled him to raise his family in a secure and loving setting, even in the face of a lot of the economic hardship that we faced during the days I was growing up. And all of this was well before the Christian right became politicized to the extent that it is now, and became the political base of a major political party, For in those days, it was all about getting your life right with God, but with no overt, at least, political agenda. All of that came years later. Well, the scene that I just described here is from about the late 1950s. I'm going to cut now to about the mid-1970s, because at this point, even though I'm only 30 years old, I've been through several lifetimes, it felt like, and was a few lifetimes removed from that setting I just talked about. I'd become quite taken with the humanistic psychology movement. Carl Rogers and Fritz Perls and all those guys. And I spent a couple summers hanging out in San Francisco and Berkeley, learning about and participating in something called Gestalt therapy, as fashioned by Dr. Perls. And this brings back some more vivid memories. In this case, it will be about 15 people or so sitting on the floor of a rather thickly carpeted room with a bunch of pillows around, and somebody would take what was called the hot seat. Actually, it was just a pillow in the middle of the group. And with the guidance of the group facilitator, whoever was sitting there in the middle would talk about the things in their life that they wanted to change and what was blocking them from doing so. Other painful events would be recalled, and greater desires for self-acceptance and personal peace would be voiced. And oftentimes it got pretty emotional. And after some measure of catharsis had been achieved by the person sitting in the middle of the group there, all these other people would move in to offer their emotional support. Hugs, tears. And it was a weird experience for me, because part of me was with that. I sort of like had one foot in that whole scene, and yet there's another piece of me that's kind of about a half a step back, looking at this whole thing, thinking, I think I've been here before. Here, in the sense that I had seen this very same dynamic at work, albeit with radically different language and with radically different faith assumptions, but the same dynamic of people facing the broken parts of their lives and reaching for some greater level of wholeness and healing and meaning. I really felt like I was back in my revivals from about 15 years earlier. And I also remember, after one such session, taking this solitary late night walk up and down San Francisco's hilly streets, and thinking, you know, maybe these humanists that I'm cozying up to here want to be saved too. I also discovered that this personal reserve of mine that I spoke about a few minutes ago was still very well intact, because I really had no more desire to sob and honk my guts out in a room full of humanistic psychology types than I did in a church full of Baptists. But don't worry about it. That's just me. You can kind of do your own thing. But that was me. Well, my participation, though, in those workshops back in the mid-70s, they were quite formative. They were quite transformative for me. They did cause me to look closely at some of the personal and professional issues I had been pushing aside, and they eventually led to the decision I made to leave even the liberal Christian ministry and enter the Unitarian Universalist ministry, which is another story that a number of you have heard, so we're going to move on. And in thinking about them, the similarities between these two scenes I just described, I also recalled a very familiar as it was made to me, passage from the New Testament Gospel of John, was often invoked way back in those revival meetings. It's the story or the legend of a very learned gentleman named Nicodemus paying a call on Jesus. Kind of in the manner of a seeker approaching a guru, you know, asking about the meaning of life. And Nicodemus says to Jesus, "Good master, what must I do to be saved?" And Jesus, in the manner of a kind of a guru, you know, they offer these cryptic, you kind of figure it out on your own kind of answers. He says, "You must be born again." Well, in the setting in which I first heard these words, you didn't really get time to think about it on your own and what all the various kinds of implications of that statement might mean, because the evangelist would jump right in on it and take off with his interpretation of what being born again meant, which was usually handled in such a narrow and damnation-threatening way. But a few years later, during my college days, I dismissed this passage, along with everything else I'd ever been told about hell. And the ironic thing is, it wasn't until many years later, When I began taking a more humanistic view of life and religion and spirituality, but I decided that Nicodemus, whoever he was actually asking the right question, and that Jesus, whoever he may have been, may well have been giving the right answer. Hold that thought. I'll get back to it. Now, maybe the New Testament verses don't resonate too well with you, so I'm going to try a more contemporary text instead. This is from Dr. M. Scott Peck's book, The Road Less Traveled. It had a pretty good run on the bestseller list several years ago, and still very widely read. Here's Dr. Peck, one passage from this book. We all have a sick self and a healthy self. Even if we seem to be totally fearful and completely rigid, there's still a part of us, however small, that wants to grow, that is attracted to the new and the unknown, and that is willing to do the work and take the risks involved in spiritual evolution. No matter how seemingly healthy and evolved we are, there's still a part of us, however small, that clings to the familiar and is fearful of any change or effort and desires comfort at any cost and the absence of pain at any price. And then Peck continues, in this one respect, we human beings are equal. Within each and every one of us, there are two selves, one sick and one healthy. Life urge and the death urge, if you will. Each of us represents the whole of the human race. Close quote. I think what Scott Peck is describing here is what you might call a humanistic version of salvation. For stripped of a lot of its cumbersome baggage and just taken on its literal level, the term salvation means moving from or being delivered from a less healthy state to a more healthy and holistic one. When you think about it, most religions, including the Judaic and the Christian ones, many of them have as part of their story or as part of their mythology an account of human beings living in a perfect or unblemished state in their Garden of Eden, if you will. And in this state, there is complete oneness, complete congruity with the self and life and creation and God, however understood or defined. Complete immediacy, complete unbroken immediacy with one's surroundings. And then, in the course of these stories, something happens. Some event happens that ruptures that relationship. And then the goal of religion after that is to try to restore that relationship according to the dictates and practices of that particular religious faith. Okay, well, stories don't come from just nowhere. Where do these stories about perfection followed by a fall from perfection come from? Well, according to Carl Jung, some things I agree with him on, some things I don't. I do agree with him on this one. He says that our accounts of our gardens of Eden, however they're told in the various world religions, ultimately come from the collective memory of the human race. That is to say, our subconscious memory of being in the pre-birth state where there was, in fact, complete immediacy with our whole universe, which at that point was the body of our mother. Birth is the rupturing or disrupting of that relationship. So feeling some degree of alienation from ourself and the world and all that we see around us is really nothing more than a consequence of our being born. And we only get one biological birth. We get a shot at other kinds of rebirth, however. So stripped then of all of its guilt-inducing overlays, this is what the term sin really means. It means separation. Separation in this case from our healthy selves, some separation and estrangement from the life and the world that we would rather be reconciled to. And we know that. We know that there are some terribly unhealed parts of our lives. We know we live in a terribly broken world that calls us to be about restoring or saving whatever small parts of it we may be able to do so with our own efforts and energies. So we are born then to feel this kind of dissonance, this kind of separation. And from this perspective, the term original sin can actually make some kind of sense. Now, the reason it doesn't make sense, to me anyway, is because certain theologians and church leaders over the centuries took this idea and went a little crazy with it. This is John Calvin, one of the principal architects of the Protestant Reformation, writing in his seminal work, Institutes of the Christian Faith. Original sin appears to be an hereditary depravity. Infants themselves, as they bring their condemnation into the world, are rendered obnoxious to punishment by their own sinfulness. And on like that. Calvin took this universal condition of our human sense of incompleteness and occasional self-alienation and transformed it, manipulated it, I would say, into something for which we deserve nothing less than the eternal punishment of God, unless we can get God to save us from it. Now, to dip into the history of our own movement for just a minute or two, it was the Unitarians and the Universalists who originated in part in opposition to, or in protest to, this idea. It was a theological revolt against this kind of Calvinism, was how this thing called Unitarianism got started, and Universalism. They were both originally liberal Christians. They believed Jesus had come to show us how to move towards our more healthy selves, to use Scott Peck's language again, than to deliver us from a fallen state. They believed in sin, as I do too, but not as a hopelessly depraved state. For the Unitarians believed in something they called salvation by character. By that, they meant that we human beings have within ourselves the resources that we need to move from our sick selves to our more healthy selves. And don't just have to rely upon divine whim to decide whether we're going to make it or not. And for these, our original Unitarian ancestors, and Jesus was the moral guide for attaining salvation by character. And I honor the presence of liberal Christianity on our wider Unitarian Universalist Communion today, and while liberal Christianity is no longer central within our liberal religious movement, I still like that idea of salvation by character. It's a very positive expression of human potential and human potentiality. It is an affirmation that we carry within us the wellsprings of hope and courage that allow us to be reborn any number of times during our life on earth. So let me leave you then with three things that I think being saved can mean for religious liberals, whether we choose to use the term or not. First of all, it means coming to know self-acceptance. Now, I don't mean this in a smug or a self-satisfied way, but rather I mean having the wherewithal to look at both the healthy and the unhealthy parts of ourselves and say yes to the whole thing. For there's a certain kind of freedom and a certain kind of deliverance that comes in not demanding perfection of oneself, of being able to say, yeah, there's some parts of me that haven't quite got there yet, not quite whole just yet, and that's okay. Now, this doesn't mean you're going to stay, it shouldn't mean that you stay stuck in that brokenness. It means that we move in the direction of our healthy selves by first confronting and acknowledging where we are, because that's where any journey of growth begins. Take that move, and to make that journey is to make a journey of rebirth. It's not always an easy one. I have to agree with the first three lines of Scott Peck's The Road Less Traveled. Life is difficult. I would say that self-affirmation or the salvation of which I'm speaking here has its best chance of being realized within a supportive and redeeming community. Within a community that is committed to affirming the inherent worth and dignity of every person, whether they're a member of that community or beyond it. And this is part of my ongoing vision for us as we are making vision statements over these weeks. Part of my ongoing vision for us is that we be that supportive and redeeming community within which our members and friends can find and build upon the strength of character that will enhance and nurture their healthy selves. For sometimes it's hard to believe that you have that kind of strength and potential on your own. But in a healing community can enable and help you to find it. And that's part of my vision for us here, that we should always be striving to be that kind of community. Second component of this humanistic salvation, as I'm calling it, is to live with a sense of being a part of something and related to something greater than yourself. I know this is a continuing theme of mine. I'll try not to belabor it here. I'm really not much interested in this humanist theist debate that seems to crop up from time to time amongst us as you use. It's gotten kind of passe, really. I do sense, though, that there is something of a consensus within our Unitarian Universalist world right now, above and beyond any debates about the existence or non-existence of a supreme being. There seems to be a consensus, a common affirmation of the presence of a life force, of a spirit of life that is around us and sustaining us. We sing about it every Sunday. And many of you have told me that our singing of spirit of life is one of the anchor points of our Sunday services for you. But to put this in more personal terms, I feel no need to be in any kind of a relationship with a supernatural supreme being. But I do feel the need for a relationship nonetheless. For part of my own sense of my personal health and wholeness is bound up in my feelings of a relationship with a larger whole, the whole of life itself that contains me within it. So this sense of relationship with the whole of life is another part of what I call being saved as a religious humanist. And every time that relationship is renewed or reaffirmed, it's a time of rebirth. Final piece of salvation, somewhat related to the one I just described, is the ability to see, within even our smallest efforts, to bring some measure of justice, compassion, love, and peace to this precious and fragile world of ours, to be able to see within that the working out of some greater purpose that will outlive our time on earth. The Reverend Fred Small, the minister of our Unitarian Universalist Church down in Littleton, Massachusetts, put it very well in the recurring words of his best-known song, Everything Possible. I've sung it here a few times. The recurring line is, "And the only measure of your words and your deeds will be the love you leave behind when you're gone." Try that again. "The only measure of your words and your deeds will be the love you leave behind when you're gone." Now, these words are really a contemporary recasting of that old Unitarian principle of salvation by character. We, personally, none of us in this room, will see everything that's possible when it comes to humanity achieving its full health and potential. We know we have to bear witness to our human folly as much as we do our human wholeness. Marking this week, the third year, a very horrible, in my opinion, needless war. But there's a certain kind of saving grace in knowing and believing that our words and our deeds will leave something positive in our wake when the measure of our days is taken. To believe that our efforts during our time on earth will in some way, even some small way, move us a little bit closer to that beloved community of humanity itself is what it means to live by faith. And we must live this way. Otherwise, why would we make such efforts in the first place? This in closing. Several years ago, one of my colleagues in the UU ministry, the Reverend Dan O'Neill, lost his life to cancer at a relatively early age. And shortly before he passed away, he sent out a meditation to his ministerial colleagues and to the congregation he was serving at that time. It's just a part of it. "Thanks for this day. A day in my life. Thanks for the stars, the earth. Thanks for death, which makes life so precious and so vibrantly alive. Thanks for it all. No exceptions." I only knew this man slightly, but still well enough to know that he was not one to sentimentalize or romanticize death. He would not want his colleagues to do the same, and so I will not. For his death, among other things, was an indication of how the workings of the natural world don't always treat us in benign ways. Sometimes they can be very cruel. But what Dan offered in this little meditation as his death approached was an affirmation of life in the face of life's inevitable end. To be able to say of one's life, thanks for it all, no exceptions, is the mark of a saved life, and one that is known as many times of rebirth. So may ours then be a saving community for all who come here, seeking some greater measure of wholeness in their lives. May our words and our deeds indeed be the true measure of the love we share with one another and which we will leave for all of those who come after us. Let's join together singing our closing hymn, which is Blessed Spirit of My Life. It's number 86.